Hello, and welcome to recording number 23 of Gary Gygax's Saga of Old City, the annotated reading. This is July 2nd, 2021. I'm going to begin here with chapter 17, page 162, paragraph 1. The great hall of the Lord Mayor's palace was aglitter with candles and flambeaux. The crowd within was a sparkling array of the elite of Stoink. His authoritative lordship Daly led the festivities, and with him were the various ward leaders, clerics, guildmaster, and other officials who were his liegemen. Attendant to all, of course, were entourages of guards, retainers, servants, and females, grand ladies as well as other sorts. The half-hundred important men, thrice that numbers of others in service to them, plus the palace guards and staff, nearly filled the huge chamber. A crowd of lesser bureaucrats and minor leaders of Stoink and its environs brought the crowd to near 300. Break. Well, here we have Boss Daly, his authoritative leadership. Gygax is rather, slightly amusing nod toward Chicago and Stoink being linked together in some way. A description here of who are the people around him at this festivity, who are the size of the Lord Mayor's palace, that it's a palace with a great hall that can hold almost 300 people just in the hall itself. And that, we have the ward leaders. So that's again, kind of a nod to Chicago and the old politics there. But we have ward leaders, clerics, and guildmasters. Now, I don't believe we have anything quite like in the city of Greyhawk, a master of the masters of the various quarters or leaders of the various quarters. Instead, we seem to have the quarters holding different kinds of things, like the university district and the river quarter and the high quarter. We don't really seem to have anybody who's in charge of the quarter as much as we have various elites and guild masters, and the guild masters being the directors of the city. So we have something a little bit different set up. That may be described later on, but a little more about how Stoink here is structured. I'm going to restart. It is page 162, paragraph 2. Long trestle tables were arrayed in the hall, and these boards groaned with the weight of the food and drink upon them. Major Domo slammed his ceremonial staff down on a wooden platform constructed so as to issue a booming sound when so struck. At this sound, minstrels ceased their strumming and singing, and jongleurs ceased their tricks, as did the capering jester. A hush fell over the place, for Boss Daly was about to speak. Lords and ladies, masters and mistresses, a few titters here, gentlefolk, welcome to this palace. Cheers and applause. You are commanded here to celebrate, because I have just saved Stoink from disaster. Louder cheers and heavy clapping. Wait, there is more than that. I have strengthened our state and assured its prominent position as leader of the Alliance of the States of the Free Lords. This last announcement precipitated such atonement of applause and cheering that Boss Daly stood silently for several minutes, hands raised, basking in the adulation. At his signal, Major Domo again made the hall boom to his staff, and the assemblage was again hushed. The boss continued, "I discovered a most wicked plot by our former allies, the Hierarchs of the Horn Society. Catcalls, hisses, boos, jeers, and whistles. Those bastards would embroil us with the cursed Tenna host, and with us most of the free lords of the East, while their filth-devouring legions ran unopposed over our brothers to the West. The boss and Lord Mayor paused here, but the listeners made little noise, for the impact of his statement was being assessed. Then he resumed, "I discovered this scheme and brought its leaders low. The agents of the Hierarchs were here. Yes, here in Holdrun. They're dead now, their war chest a part of our treasury. And the men-at-arms they recruited with deceit and lies now serve me. Soon I ride with them to Riftcrag. There a grand council of free lords will meet, and there we will pursue our crusade to remove the Hierarchs' troops from warfields and Wormhall, and I shall be chief of lords." Daily beamed as a storm of wild jubilation swept through the crowd and filled the hall with such noise that even the most strenuous beating of the mace butt on the drum boards could not be heard above the din. The magic user in the back took the opportunity to cause an illusion of appropriate nature to appear. A line of chained hobgoblins clanked through the suddenly open doors of the chamber. Each carried the head of a human on a golden platter, and each bloody head was crowned with a horn coronet. This file of captives and grisly trophies was guarded by huge soldiers in black armor, armed with halberds, and wearing the blazon of Stoink, a white field enveloped with an azure bend and a golden spear superimposed above all. As this procession entered, heralds blew silver trumpets, likewise decorated with armorial bearings. The throng quieted as everyone turned to watch the spectacle. The audience applauded when the hobgoblin captives hurled the heads down at the table before the boss, and each gory pate dissolved into a shower of golden coins and rainbow-hued jewels. Mace drummed again, the illusion vanished, and the onlookers were again silent. Break. Now, we have this gathering here by Boss Daly in the Great Hall of the Lord Mayor's Palace, one of the things that strikes me is that that Bailey describes himself as the leader of the Alliance of the States of the Free Lords. Now, that, again, and he calls himself later that he'll be chief of lords when he meets with the other free lords, the Grand Council, at Riftcrag. Now, this is the first I've really heard or remember of there being anyone claiming to be the leader or of the Alliance of the States of the Free Lords. And it may just be coming from Boss Daly's viewpoint of this, and the other free lords may decry anything like this, or the bandit kingdoms, they are under attack in several areas, the Pale, the Tenna, and the Hierarchs have all taken some of the bandit kingdoms. So you know, it could be that Boss Daly does end up, or is, the head of this alliance, but I hadn't heard that before. They're relating, it seems like he's relating what has happened with Gord and Geller. So, you know, it would seem that maybe Geller has some kind of connection, or he is part of the Thieves Guild. He says he's high up in it. And again, part of the people who are, you know, part of the ruling class here in Stoink, but here he is one of them, and so maybe just turned over the information. Geller mentions that the money and troops are also turned over to him, but I kind of think that probably the coin has gone the way of as much of it into the pockets of Gord and Geller as possible. We have a little description here of the Blazon of Stoink. I don't have that on hand, but he describes it as a a white field embellished with an azure bend, and a golden spear superimposed above all. So that would, you know, I'm not sure. There probably is in the setting material, like in the folio of the Greyhawk folio, there's probably a heraldry for Stoink. I'm not sure. And that could be the description of it.
Yeah, there definitely is. I'm getting it ready now.
Okay, because, you know, I'm not sure of the various heraldry offhand, but I bet it matches up because this is definitely written well after the beginning of the setting in 1980. I don't know how long it took for Gygax to write this, but I don't think he could really have written this before, you know, the folio came out, because at that time, he had a very sketchy idea of what a publishable setting would be like. And he was running his own campaign, which wasn't, you know, which wasn't like that at all. So here on the Greyhawk Fiction text channel, we can post various pictures and things and lists, and people who want to can write in comments and questions that we'll address. And if they don't want to actually speak within the channel itself. All right. I'm going to restart here. And it is page 164, paragraph 2. There is just... Before I do that, I wanted to just mention that this is one of the few occasions where we actually see some magic being cast. Now, you know, he refers it to as a magic user, but it really is an illusionist. Now, if you were on the fiction text, or if you could get back to it for July 2nd, 2021, here is a picture of the map showing Stoink, the Stoink location, and also the heraldry for Stoink, which is as described, you know, a white field, an azure bend, and a golden spear above all of them, or on top of all of them in the middle. All right, now I'm going to restart page 164, paragraph 2. There is just a little more, dear peers and subjects. I did not accomplish this all alone. Faithful men serve to assist, and we are here not only to celebrate my triumph, but to share with these subjects our glory and accomplishment. Subdued remarks as to the generosity and magnanimity of the boss accompanied the applause that followed this remark. The honored guests of the revel are here near me. I present them to you all. Geller, a magsman of our Thieves Guild, and his associate Gord, a free sword late of Lukesh, and likewise a member of our guild. It is our decision that each be given honor hereafter as deputy bailiffs and subalterns of the constabulary guard. Break. Well, you know, this is just two quick paragraphs, but yeah, what it does, there's a couple key things I think that are here. Is one, that first thing I noticed is that Daly, he refers to the people there as his peers and subjects. Now, that you know, that kind of indicates that the people, at least from what he's saying, that the elite there, they're considered to be a peer on an equal basis with Daly. Now, Daly is obviously, you know, the boss, the head of Stoink, the Lord Mayor. We don't know the permanence of that position. My assumption is that it is a permanent position, and you know, like maybe they have elections, maybe they have appointments and things. But I kind of seems like Boss Daly, from the connotations of the name, is a bit of, you know, that he's going to be like mayor for life. Now, But the comment that there are peers, I think, is very revealing. And then we get this business where I'd be interested to know, I'm not familiar with the term mags man, so I'm not quite sure how far up in the Guild of Thieves that would put Geller. But the other thing is that Daly refers to it as our Thieves Guild. He is either referring it to it as our guild as Stoink's guild, or our guild as his own guild. And it could be that the guilds are seen as either, a possession of Stoink, which Bailey runs, or direct possession, directly under his control. So it would be interesting to find out what is exactly meant by that. Now, he appoints Gordon Geller deputy bailiffs. And and here we have Magsman is a con man who tries to deceive members of the public, which, again, it's obviously used here as a rank. Gygax was fond of that in AD&D, of giving names for levels rank names, level names. So Magsman may either indicate a skill level or an authoritative level within the Thieves Guild. And I would assume that it also, reflects, again, this theme of deception among the thieves. There always seems to be that thievery, as Gygax has been writing it in these various places, holds a great deal of deception other than outright robbery and burglary. But getting back to this, early in the book, when Gord is caught as a 12-year-old for thieving, he is put before a justice, a bailiff. Now, I had understood bailiff to be, in modern usage, the person who is there to keep order within a courthouse. And I know that there was an English term, they bring the bailiff in. And I had assumed that, again, that was more of a lawman or somebody acting as police and force. But the way it was used earlier was the bailiff was the judge. And I'm not sure if these are deputy judges or whether they are a different form of bailiff or force, more lawman. And subaltern of the constabulary guard. A subaltern is normally like a military title. I believe it's like an ensign or a very low-ranking officer trainee. I believe that's the appropriate definition, but I'm not quite sure how it's used right here. All right, I'm going to restart. We're on page 164, and this is paragraph 4. There was polite a pause, and a few raised eyebrows at this, for the boss never gave out such positions unless something big had been done by the recipients. Deputy bailiff status literally meant license to steal, and that office, as well as that of the guard, bore remunerations that even after payoffs and kickbacks, would amount to 5 or 6 luckies a month for no work. The pair now standing and inclining their heads were watching by each of the assembled officials, either as potential rivals or possible climbers whose friendship could be useful. Then his authoritative lordship, signaled for the festivities to continue, and the revelers were soon engaged in eating, drinking, and conversation once again. Break. All right, now we have again this thing about the deputy bailiff, and it's again it's not clear to me quite whether that is a judge or a lawman, or some kind of, definitely not like the bailiff in a court of modern times where he can maintains order in the court. It would seem like it would be a good way to the license to steal. It kind of makes me think that it's the kind of bailiff who goes out and you know, is called in for disputes and various things rather than a judge, but he might have several kinds of you know, several things that he's responsible for in that position. Now, their remuneration at say 5 or 6 luckies a month, that is quite a lot. I mean, we're talking either around half a gold piece every month, and you know, that's nothing in a straightforward AD&D campaign. And yet, in this this campaign, Gygax's has gold is very valuable. So that much money coming in should easily be able to support someone in a reasonable, comfortable status. Not a really high-fluting, big-time living status, but just that as the nominal money that they're making for those positions and doing nothing else, that should be, you know, that should be a very, you know, nice, say, middleman or upper middleman kind of pay right there. And depending how much money they make from graft and corruption or outright theft, that, you know, is undetermined. And yet, you know, the city of Stoink is under a great deal of control because of Boss Daly. So there, it is not a great place to be a thief, but it might be a good way, say, to exploit the visitors coming into Stoink.
Now, license to steal. Do you think that means they can steal from anyone, even those people the boss has said is off limits?
No, I think that is. I'm not sure whether it's used directly as in direct theft, or just as like a platitude, like here. He's got license to steal. It's just like a familiar term, you know, in Stoink.
Like they called smog the greatest of calamities, something like that.
Yes, that's right. And there's a lot of things it could be. In my mind, I kind of see that deputy bailiff position is maybe they could exploit anyone not under the boss's protection, like charge, you know, almost like a little racketeering going on, but also. They might be able to set fees for the newcomers coming from Rat's Wharf and in Haldrun. They might charge for, you know, every group or people who are recruiting. I could see there could be a lot of, graft and corruption with that. And I think that, to my mind, makes a little more sense. Gygax may explain it later. Just in yesterday's recording, he explained that Gord had slipped the leader of those mercenaries a Mickey.
We had suspected that, but we weren't shown it.
Yes, and he saved it as a reveal. And then Geller reveals that he knew exactly what Gord was planning, and he went along with it and acted out a part to raise the value of things. So, you know, a lot of things that we see. And then at the end, there was also that the Hierarchs were behind it all, because they found a secret, they found a pay chest, and they got into the bottom of it in a secret area, and there were coins showing the Hierarch, the gold orbs. So they were the same kind of orbs that you would see in other places like Greyhawk, a city of Greyhawk, but they had the emblem of the Hierarchs on the sides, so they minted their own coins. I always wonder why there aren't differing size coins, like, you know, instead of like a 10 gold point, a 10 gold piece value coin, or a 50 gold piece, just being bigger, you know, just being a bigger amount of gold, because it really does seem like the value of the item is the metal, rather than trying to put faith in something that is by that government. Like, instead of a paper, like a dollar bill or a $10 bill or $100, which is just with no intrinsic value, this all the coin seems to have an intrinsic value. So you could have, if it's that, then you're doing it by weight. Like, you know, a bronze might be an ounce of bronze, or, you know, and that weight might be standard, and that is what, like the Electrum Lucky, it should be a standardized weight of coin. But that doesn't mean you couldn't have like a 5 lucky piece or a 10 lucky piece that was simply a bigger coin with more of the metal inside of it. Which is a bit of a digression, but I love talking about the coinage here.
With hard money like that, if you were to carry like a 50 gold piece value coin, it would be very heavy.
Yeah, depending on the size. Now, see, we're not hearing the weight value. Now, like something like iron or copper, the bronze and stuff, they may be like 1 ounce coins. Or they may be lighter, because I believe copper's a fairly light metal, whereas gold's a heavier one. Now, it might be that a gold orb is not that big. You know, I mean, it could be the size of an American dime, and that's the orb. And then when it got to be, you know, a nickel size or quarter size or a half dollar size, that could be, you know, a 2 gold piece or a 5 gold piece. So if they're doing it by weight, it hasn't mentioned whether the weights are standard, you know. So a gold coin, like, it might be that it's a tenth of an ounce, so that, so that you would need like 50 of them would only be 5 ounce, it would be a 5 ounce coin. Now, 5 ounce coin of gold would still be a pretty sizable one, but in the past in the United States, they had Double Eagle $20 pieces. I think they had $50 pieces of American coinage in gold, and they were big. And it's like we had those half-dollar pieces, you know, for a while, and then the last ones were the Ike dollar 50-cent pieces, and they were much bigger. Or were the Ikes 50s, or were they? No, were they were dollars.
But it was a Kennedy half-dollar.
It was a Kennedy half-dollar and an Ike dollar. And the Eisenhower dollar coins were big, you know. And, you know, then look, they came out with those little fake gold-looking dollar coins.
Right.
What were they? The Sacagawea coin. Uh-huh. And
Lewis so, and Clark.
Yeah, and those were just, you know, and none of them were by the metal content. You know, once we ended the Ben Franklin half. I think there was a Ben Franklin 50-cent piece that was all silver. And, you know, I don't think at the point that was being minted at the end that it was worth 50 cents. You know, I don't think it was 50 cents worth of silver. It was a, you know, it was like a little bond that, you know, the U.S. is saying that you, that this might not be, you know, silver, but it is worth so much. And they used to back American paper money with actual metal coinage.
And you were Knox or something.
And you would get these things called, they would look like a normal dollar, but, you know, like from the 20s or, but instead they would say silver certificate on them. And they were a dollar or such, but you could turn it in for silver.
Yeah, they had like a blue seal, I think.
Yeah, they you know, I guess to give it a little silvery look. And here, so here with this, you know, we don't know what the coinage will, you know, about the weights in the coins. Now, I know there was some mention in some things of Stoink minting its own coins, but it's, so far there's no mention of that either. All right, so they have the bailiff position and a military position with the constabulary guard. And it's hard to say. Now, constabulary points it out as a police force. And yet, Stoink is very big. And I mean more than just the city. So you could, they have the watch and that they mentioned, and they have the guard. And then I would think that either one of those forces actually goes out into the countryside as an army, or to force enforce law and order, and a relative, perhaps maybe just like to protect tax collectors and such. But Stoink itself, I believe, was 14,000, and an additional 50,000 to 70,000 around Stoink because it controls the area around it. Here we have pointing out that Stoink is one of the areas that has centers of worship of Istis, who is a Baclunish goddess of fate. It gives a little information. That was from the World of Greyhawk box set, the 83 box set that mentions mm-hmm. Stoink.
Yeah,
and there are, for, you know, I mean...
I was looking for heraldry, and I came upon that.
Yeah, and one of the things is there is... there is references to Stoink, but I don't believe there's anything as detailed as we're getting in this book right here. I think we started talking about Stoink at the end of recording 19, and here we are in recording 23, which is going on four hours later, that we're covering about so far about 64 pages about Stoink. It is surprising how much information. Now, this is, again, it's the bare bones kind of thing and picking up stuff, but there are a lot of details here about Stoink, and one of the things that we're doing right here is trying to find things, the words here that have greater meaning that you can extract from the story here. I think I'll start reading again here. It is page 164 and paragraph 5. Ord was seated next to the most beautiful woman he had ever seen, and all of his attention was on her. Evelie was her name, Lady Evelie. Her hair of pale platinum and her violet eyes bespoke elvish blood. Perhaps from a grandparent or great-grandparent. Gord could not guess which, and anyway cared for nothing save the result. Break. And a little jump that on page 165, there is a Clyde Caldwell drawing of Evelyn in her, you know, very revealing gown right there. And Clyde Caldwell did excellent illustrations. If you don't have the book, here on the Fiction Channel, look up today's date, the 2nd of July, 2021, and we have here a picture of Evelie from the book. Now, the other thing I wanted to say is that, right stopping with this paragraph, is besides that, here we have introduction of Lady Evelie, who has a decent role, not just in this, but at least in fan-created material, and I think maybe in Sargent, and to do with, I believe it's the Spine Castle area. Now, I thought one of the things that really struck me is the violet eyes and pale platinum hair as a mark of elvish blood. Now, I've always thought that pale hair with the drow was, kind of unique to them and maybe a result of being underground and the radiation of the vault affecting them. But here we have, it's said that pale platinum blonde is a mark of the elf. So it would seem that pale platinum hair that we're seeing in the drow may actually just be common to other elves on the surface.
Because, yeah, I always thought the purple eyes were a drow characteristic, too.
Yeah, and here, they don't know about the drow. He hasn't encountered them yet. And here, she's being marked as having elvish blood because of these eyes and this hair. So, I don't know. I would guess then that Gygax saw both those as part of some elven heritage and maybe a link to the ancestry of the drow, maybe there was a time when all the elves looked very similar and then split apart into the various subgroups, like Sylvan Elf, Gray Elf, High Elf. And here, we have it still that some group of surface-dwelling elves must have pale hair and violet eyes. And that is something I haven't noted anywhere else before. Right, I'm going to restart. Is page 164, last paragraph. Evely was gowned in velvet of the same color as her eyes, and the low bodice of the dress revealed the perfect symmetry of her creamy breasts. Ward found himself staring at the single amethyst nestled between these hemispheres, and wishing he were that pendant. And she turned to speak to him. Her long tresses, bound by a fillet of thin gold, rippled as silk stirred by a soft breeze. It was difficult for Gord to understand what she said, because her full mouth and soft lips fascinated his eyes to such an extent that his audio senses seemed out of touch with his brain. The young woman's face was somewhat drawn, however, and Gord saw great sadness behind the beauty of her eyes. Evely demonstrated no particular enjoyment of the banquet celebration, no happiness in being at the boss's head table, no pleasure at the flirtation and compliments from the officials and influential men who sought her attention. Gord wanted to be alone with her, and he finally decided to give voice to his thoughts in the hope that he could improve her disposition and give himself some pleasure too, by taking her away from the table. "I ask your ladyship to stroll in the park gardens," he said, a bit nervously in spite of himself. "You must ask Lordship Daly, for I am in his charge, and unless I have his permission, I can go nowhere," she replied with a faint smile. Did her flute-like voice offer hope or discouragement? Gord was uncertain, but he determined to play it out. "Thank you, Lady Evely, for your intelligence. Pardon me that I knew not you were the ward of his authoritative lordship, Boss Daly. I am new to the town, you know. I shall ask permission at once." Although they were being honored, Keller and Gord were not seated next to the potentate of the city-state, but rather two or three places respectively from him. Seeing that the great lord was engrossed in discussion with a rat-faced man to his left, Gord signaled a varlet behind his chair to come to Gord's place. A surly man dressed in a soiled tabard that identified him as one of the Lord Mayor's staff came over slowly, but Gord did not berate him for insolence. Instead, he slipped a common into the fellow's hand and whispered instructions in his ear. The servant grinned, nodded, and went back to his station. A minute later, the fellow managed to slide into a pause in his master's conversation and murmur Gord's request. Boss Daly turned and met Gord's eyes. He was smiling broadly, but Gord read the hard assessment in the gaze. Then the varlet said something else in his master's ear that made Lord Daly's great jowls shake with laughter. "Gentle Gord, our new subaltern, your request to accompany Lady Evely on a stroll through the palace garden is granted on three conditions." Everyone else at the table turned to stare at Gord. Evidently, he had done something amiss, but he was not abashed. He responded quickly and firmly, "Your conditions, my lord, are my orders." "Well said, lad. Here are our con orders, then. First, her ladyship must agree." At this, everyone laughed, although Gord was sure that there was jealousy behind some of the mirthful expressions. "Second, you must guard her from all harm and return her to us immediately after your exercise and fresh air are done. Third and last, you must return her intact, for she is a virgin, and without her maidenhead, her value to us plummets." At that, raucous sounds, ribald laughter, and rude jest filled the whole of the great hall. Gord, surprised at these statements, was slightly amused himself, until he saw Evelise's blush of anger and humiliation. There was something here he must learn, and quickly, if he was to attain his most desired goal, the fair damsel's heart, and attendant parts, of course. Thank you, your authoritative lordship. Consider all to be as you command. Well, here we have, mostly this is about Gord, and a little about what, you know, the scenario that is developing right here with Evelise and Boss Daly and what is truly going on that Gord isn't aware of. And we can think that Gord, this also reflects something that is a pretty much a theme with Gord. He is not, at this point, very good around women. He still has that naivete. And if we think back to the René, when he was looking at the women and got entangled with Estrella, again, it was because he did not understand the culture that he was in. He did not understand things that were not being told to him, and he made other assumptions. And so again, we have Gord showing that he's trying to be a little suaver, but he still seems like relatively inexperienced. So there isn't too much setting-wise in this, except since Evelise is more of a noted NPC character, there's things that you could do in the history of the game, as a background in your own campaign, and as a adventure ideas, you know, from the situation that is occurring right here.
It shows a little bit about what Daly thinks of himself as they capitalize our and us. He has a very high opinion of himself.
Yes, he reminds me quite a bit of Theobald.
Yeah.
And again, we have with Theobald, you know, here, Theobald with Violet, in a different respect, that she was, you know, not kind of a captive to him, but still, you know, that she was his mistress. But still, here is Gord getting involved with a Theobald-like character with another beautiful woman. So, you know, there is a type that Gord seems to, a type of situation that seems to attract Gord. And here he is in it again.
Well, he's still a relatively young man, so it's easy to understand.
Yes, and if you think that a lot of it, the time he has spent, you know, when he was hiding out in the university district, I mean, he did a year of the tutoring and 2 years at Gray College. So there is, you know, a chunk of his early life that may not have been as, you know, carefree and going after various women and stuff. And maybe no chance to actually meet one that was in his society. Like Violet, despite being a, you know, prostitute and a thief, she was part of his early society. And, you know, and then Estrella and Adez were part of his adopted society with René, as his, since he was an adopted René. And now he's been made part of, you know, first he's part of the Beggar Guild, Beggar Union. Then he's adopted into the René. And now he has been made a deputy bailiff and subaltern in Stoink. So in each situation, he's been brought into these societies, but he also it gets in trouble because he isn't fully, you know, fully aware of the, he's newly into these societies and not really fully aware of consequences.
Well, he got in trouble with Light too.
Oh yes. Only, you know,
Cannon's daughter.
That's right. I forgot about her. And the situation there is kind of similar.
I mean, I guess with Light and Adaz, he kind of used them. Whereas with the other three, he didn't really use his head.
Yeah. Now, I mean, with Violet, he was in love. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the thing with Adaz was he was very interested in her, but was a little soured by running into Estrella. And with Light, by that time, he definitely didn't seem to be in love with Light, although we get very little information. But he didn't seem to be in love with her. And here, He seems to be more, and while he's interested in Evelie's body, he also seems to be interested in a little romance with her as well. Because they're talking about, how wanted to attain Evelie's damsel's heart. I think that is more true than just, casually said. I think that's supposed to be, that seems to be one of the elements of Gord, is that he does fall for women fairly easily. Okay, I'm going to restart. And it is page 167, and it is paragraph 6. Thank you, your authoritative lordship. Consider all to be as you command. Gord turned and smiled reassuringly at Evelie, saying as he did so, I seem to be as much a butt of this cruel joke as you, lady. I humbly crave your pardon for unwittingly subjecting you to such discomfort. It is now my fervent wish that I had never asked, but since I have, and his lordship of Stoink has generously given permission, I now ask again, will you allow me to accompany you on a walk of the grounds? It is loud and hot in the hall. Evelie searched his face for a brief moment before responding, I thank you, sir, for your kindness, and I most readily accept. We're soon strolling through the gardens of the palace, alone save for a pair of guards following some distance behind, and occasional sentries they encountered keeping their appointed rounds. Gord slowly toward the park with Evelie's arm in his, keeping the conversation light and impersonal. She played her part, too, commenting on the fragrance of the night-blooming flowers and shrubs, and asking Gord small questions about himself. As they entered a grassy circle, Gord stopped and peered upward at the myriad stars and the two moons, the pale one shedding full beams upon them, the small blue one little more than a thin crescent rising. His pausing so caused Evelie to do the same, and as both stood gazing at the heavens, their escort remained a comfortable ways off, hidden in the deep shadows of the hedge. Break. My main comment here is that this is the first mention that I can remember here of the double moons, and like a little brief description of them. The other is, I think he mentioned it before, but the other is that about the park near the Lord Mayor's Palace, or within the grounds of the Lord Mayor's Palace. So we have a little bit of an idea. We've got the Mayor's Palace as being a very large structure. The great main room can hold 300 people. That there's a park near it or inside the grounds of it. We have that, the sentries patrol it. And then finally, this about the two moons. There's one that is pale, and the other small and blue. And again, that's the first time I think that the double moon has actually been mentioned, and something that is often, I myself have often overlooked in the past the double moons. I've not really thought too much about using it in my campaign. All right, I'm going to restart here. It is page 168, paragraph 2. Gord seized the opportunity. My lady, what is it that troubles you so? He asked. Captivity is a hard burden to bear, sir, she replied with a tinge of hardness in her musical voice. Durance, lady, is vile indeed. It is you who hold my heart captive, he said, speaking softly but with sincerity. Being a ward of the master of all around us is not captivity, but rather privilege. Evelie glared at him. Take back those words, sir, she said, or I swear I shall have revenge for your taunting me so. The response nearly left Gord speechless. The vehemence of this wonderful woman was undeniable. He hastened to make amends. Again, I am at a severe disadvantage, fair lady, he said as graciously as he could. Do not become angry at me for some ignorance on my part. Be generous and kind, I beg of you. Tell me the cause of your anger, the source of what discommodes you, and I shall pledge myself to serve to remedy all and make right what you view as wrong, even at the cost of my very life. Break. Now, here, Gord, and this is again about Gord, is that here again we have Gord, I think, showing, you know, it talks about him, how she has held captive his heart. Now, again, that is, you know, could just be a little romantic flippery there, but I think with Gord, it is an indication, really, and seems to be how he kind of like falls in love in a little Romeo way at the drop of a hat. And I think he is fairly sincere about this then. I don't think that, you know, when you scratch the surface, that Gord is not being sincere. I think that Gord is very, you know, how Gord in the past, he gets bored with things. He seems to fall in love very quickly. Gord has a very flighty side to him, but I think he sincerely means things. And I think to a great deal of his ability, he will try to do something for Evelie, even putting himself in danger. And I mention how he gets bored with things and puts himself in precarious situations and looking for adventure. I think that's a combination of why he could be true in his word to Evelie, because it serves a double purpose. It feeds the romantic part of his soul, and at the same time, it feeds this desire for adventure that Gord seems to have. We don't really, we're only shown here a little bit here that Evelie is a captive rather than the ward that Gord has taken her for. Let me see, was there anything else right here? Now, I think that's really all I get out of this section right here, mostly about being Gord, about things about the Gord storyline and developing its character. All right, I am going to restart right here. It is page 168, and it is the third paragraph from the end. Now it was Evelie who appeared taken aback. For a long moment, she looked into the young man's eyes, searching his countenance, contemplating. Then at last she spoke. Gord, I may have misjudged you. Know you who I am. Only fair, Evelie, that you are the most gorgeous woman ever to have walked our earth's thus blessed soil, and the one for whom I would most gladly die. Spare me these plights, Gord, no matter how sincerely meant and well spoken. Answer me directly, do you know who I am? The woman of my dreams, the one I love, the charge of Lord Daly, that is the full recital. Evelie slipped her small hand into Gord's as he spoke thus, standing close and staring into his face. She asked him, and that is all. On everything I honor and cherish, lady, that is all. Then hear what I am about to relate. Within a few moments, Gord had the essence of her story. Evelie was a captive, being held for ransom by Stoink. Her land was far to the east, and her father was Dunstan, Count of Blamoux, and Lord of Nurl. Boss Daly was keeping her intact, as it were, pending a reply from her father to a demand of 10,000 orbs for Evelie's safe return to her home. Time was beginning to grow short, for several months had passed without response from the noble grace of Blamoux. Unless she was ransomed soon, Evelie would be sold off to the leader of Rookroost, Plar Teod Fent, who had offered Daly treasure and alliance for her. To be sure, 10,000 gold pieces outweighed the sums proffered by Rookroost's, vague alliances aside, but meat in the pot was worth far more than magic in the promise, as they said. Thus the upshot was that Evelie was bound for the tender mercies of concubinage of the Plar, unless her father's emissaries soon reached Stoink, or fate intervened. Break. Right. Now, you know, here's a good bit of campaign information. and you know, also used later in the setting, is that Evely is the daughter of Dunstan, Count of Blamut, Lord of Nerl, you know, which is the area, I think, just south around Spine Castle. And then we have, you know, some things about the Plar Teodfent of Rookroost. Now, this is the first time, I'm not quite sure what the title Plar means. I've heard it defined before, but it hasn't stuck with me. Again, we have an advancement of this plot and the storyline. And again, if we look at Gord, he is a particularly Romeo-like character, where she's asking him to be, you know, to answer her directly, and instead he comes out with more of you know, his little romantic plights to her. You know, that she is the woman of his dreams, his one love, and yet he has met her only, just a little while before, and here Gord is expressing all this that she even says might be sincere, and it does seem like that this might be sincerity from Gord. Now, if you want to check out again the Greyhawk fiction on the Discord channel, we have a map here of the area showing Nurl and the Blemu Hills to give you an idea of what she's talking about. You know, it's east of the Flinty Hills, so it's a little removed there from Stoink. I know this map does not have the hexes or the old Darlene map scale from hexes, so I don't think it's as vast an area as a Darlene hex might show. It might only be you know, several hexes from in the Darlene map, but here we have where the Blemu Hills and Nurl are. Again, we have the some signals of elevation on this map, and I'm not sure how they match the various courses of water here. They do seem to, I think this may be Anna Meyer's map, a fragment of it, and it does show. Anna's map. Okay, and it shows, because she's done a lot of work on the waters, and it does show here, you know, around Nurl, and lower elevation than the Blemu Hills, the river running here, and the couple of small lakes. Generally, we have the water going where it should be, in a kind of valley between the Flinty Hills and the Blemu Hills. Now, we didn't get too much information about Stoink today, but we have some more details on what could be a campaign idea, and even taken directly about the kidnapping of Evely. And you can remove Gord from that idea and instead put in your own characters and run in it as an adventure. We have a little bit of description of the Lord Mayor's palace and a little bit about the park around it. But again, this tonight was mostly about showing Gord's character, you know, his kind of romantic side. And the other part is setting up the story, moving forward, and perhaps a good idea here of what you can use in your own campaign as an idea for an adventure, or even just as background lore and information about what has happened, or, you know, what is happening currently in your campaign, depending on what year you're playing at. All right, we are on page 169, and I'm going to end for tonight on... it's the ending on paragraph 6, and I'll start tomorrow on paragraph 7. Hopefully down the road I'll have a list of what page numbers are covered in each recording, and maybe a little blurb about what is talked about in the recording. Like tonight, we're again talking about Stoink, and we're talking about what happened at this celebration given by Lord Daly, and beginning the introduction here of Evely and her story. And if you're very interested in Stoink or interested in Evely, this is a good place to start listening. Even if you want to skip around at the various recordings, hopefully we can set it up so that you can know which ones to start at, or rather than just listening from 1 to 50, where it may end up going.
We got a little bit about the moons too.
Yes, and this is, and it's worth noting, like with a comic book, where certain things are introduced. We don't have much info about the moons, but again, it is nice that it is. There's a little information about the big one. They're not named here, and I'm not sure what Gygax is going to name them. I believe in this book, at least, they should be, if they're ever mentioned again. This is something, when I indexed this material, you would not have had me list this because there was no specific noun being mentioned, so that I would not have caught to list when I was first doing my indexing that the moons, I should have made a point of indexing the moons here, because this is their first mention, and you really don't need to get their names down to know that here they're mentioned, just as the moons.
Yeah, I think I must have missed it the first time I read it.
Yeah, and I've missed so much. I mean, I've read this book in particular probably over 7 times. And, one time with the depth index where I tried to look through it for just such things. And it is very easy to miss, especially when they're referring to uncapitalized, names and such, like the moons in a general form. And I was looking for something more specific. So doing this way, especially with your help, is really picks out all these little things that were missed in originally, and also in commenting, looking at it at not just for specifics, but for the general ideas about adventure and character and atmosphere, that here we are given a little bit of the atmosphere of Stoink. They're how they're all laughing at Evely and Gord, and showing that that they're not nice. Whereas Gord sometimes is, he is supposed to be much nicer, but some of his actions seem pretty outright evil. Like yesterday, when in the reading, it turns out that he burns Flatchet alive. Not the actions of a paladin by any mean.
That was work, though.
Yeah, well, I missed that. What was that?
I said that was work. So maybe he's able to separate what he does for a living from personal attachments. I don't know. I'm just speculating.
No. I mean, if you look at what he did to Adaz, he didn't just use her to steal something. He used her with the chance of terrible punishment of coming from her if she was caught. And, she wasn't, so we don't know if he would have done anything to rescue her. I hadn't thought of that originally. But, again, some of his actions are very harsh and are very, even with the fantasy campaign setting, Gygax did try to instill an absolute morality in his good and evil alignments. And it just seems that some of the actions Gord's take are just evil.
Definitely not a good character.
And they really push the boundaries of neutrality. I really found that, they give the mercy stroke to the wounded, even enemy wounded, and yet they didn't give it to Flatchet. So.
Oh, yeah, Finn was doing that, right?
Finn was there giving the mercy stroke. I mean, he could have just robbed these people, but instead... And we killed him, and Flatchet, they left him comatose in this hut on the bed with the bodies of his lieutenants and then set it on fire. And they could simply have killed him before they left. It was a very unnecessarily harsh act that Gygax... I mean, Gygax really gets particulars here, so it really struck me as, you know, very harsh and hard to put that down as anything but an evil act. Well, it's 7:04, a little past my time here, so I am going to end up for tonight, and I've given the end. Probably should have saved that, but again, this is ending on page 169. All right, well, good night, and we've got a holiday weekend coming up. I'm not sure of the schedule for the show here for the readings, but if not, then if I don't see it tomorrow or Sunday, I'll be back doing this on Monday. All right, and I'm going to close up here and say goodnight to Craig. See if I can get this spelled right.